I neglected to welcome our newest member of the court at the beginning of this last case, which was a death penalty case. And I commend Justice Bruner for joining us, and note that the first case she hears is one of the most serious that we are charged with hearing. So that was not intentional, Justice. It's just the way it worked out. But welcome, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to join you all.
Thank you. Our next case, our second case, is 2020-612, Aaron Gabbard et al. Versus the Madison Local School District Board of Education et al. We have for the appellant, Mr. Blickensderfer.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor.
Good morning.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, I am Matt Blickensderfer on behalf of the Madison Local School District Board of Education and its superintendent, Dr. Lisa Tuttle-Huff. I'd like to reserve 2 of my 10 minutes for rebuttal. Kaiser Blakely of the Attorney General's Office will take the remaining 5 minutes of the appellant's time. Your Honors, there can be no dispute that RC 2923.122D, what I'll call the authorization statute, allows a school district to authorize anyone to carry a firearm in a school safety zone. So the baseline here is local control. The General Assembly has given local school boards discretion to use this authority or not as they see fit. The question before the court, of course, is whether a separate statute, RC 109.78D, mandates completion of peace officer training for school employees who are so authorized under the authorization statute. Even on its own terms, Your Honors, RC 109.78D does not require peace officer training for school employees, except those whose primary role is to provide security. This interpretation becomes even clearer when the authorization statute and RC 109.78D are interpreted together, as they must be.
Counsel, where does 109.78D say it's their primary role? The language says no school shall employ a person as a special police officer, security guard, or other position in which such person goes armed while on duty.
It doesn't use the word primary, Chief Justice O'Connor, but the context of the provision, special police officer, a school security guard, or other position in which they go armed on duty, implies that it is a person whose role is to provide security. Under ordinary linguistics, that's how English speakers understand that kind of sequence, that phraseology.
Well, isn't the teacher that is armed, or the employee of the school that is armed, is there to provide security, are they not?
The teacher that is armed is there to provide a backdrop. A backstop, excuse me, Your Honor, for the protection of staff. I mean, in a literal sense, is that providing security? Yes, it is in a literal sense. But if the General Assembly had intended, Your Honor, for all employees who are authorized under the authorization statute to be covered by 109.78D, this would have been a very strange way to have accomplished that. The phrasing is very particular, Your Honor. It's other position in which such person goes armed while on duty. And that, just as a matter of ordinary linguistics, suggests that it's a security role, not the algebra teacher who's been authorized to carry a weapon on school property.
But the algebra teacher with a weapon on their person is there to secure the safety of the students and coworkers.
In a literal sense, absolutely, Chief Justice.
Okay, we're talking literal, reading. Now, not every school has a security guard or a special police officer, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so in many, many of the schools in Ohio, our algebra teacher that is armed is the security on site.
I have to agree with that. Yes, Your Honor. I agree with that. I mean,
then how is that algebra teacher not a person in other position in which such person goes armed while on duty. How is that algebra teacher not described in that clause of the statute?
Because, Your Honor, that clause is not separate, it's not discrete. It's connected to what comes before it, which is special police officer and security guard. And that residual clause, I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
Well, it says, or other person, which, so it's not the same as a police officer or security guard.
Correct. It's intended, in our view, it's intended to be a residual clause to take care of nomenclature issues. For instance, well, schools hire, I'm sorry, is there a question?
No, go ahead, you finish your sentence.
Yeah, thank you, Justice Stewart. It's schools hire employees called school resource officers. There's an example from an attorney general opinion where the Parma School District hired someone called the supervisor of safety and security. The residual clause, in our view, is intended to encompass those sorts of positions, regardless of what they are called. And in a literal sense, which is what the other side is advocating for, we can pluck words out of the phrase, a position, armed and on duty, and say yes, those three boxes are checked in a literal sense. But as Justice Thomas has said, the literal meaning is often not the plain meaning. I think he said plain meaning is often not the literal meaning. But the point that I would make about the phrasing is it's connected to what precedes it under the canon of justum generis and just ordinary linguistics.
But Mr. Blickensderfer, I'm sorry, what's the overarching goal of all of this? Isn't this to allow educators in a school to be armed in these days of school shootings to help protect themselves, their students, their colleagues? But then parents, I'm sure, are still going to want adults in the building with their children to know how to safely secure that weapon and to safely use that weapon, correct?
That is eminently reasonable, Justice Stewart.
So what does, and so your argument to you here is that if these teachers are required to comply with 109, with RC 109.78, that's unduly burdensome. That's more than they have to do. They're full-time educators, not full-time peace officers or police officers. So then isn't it the legislature's duty to come up with something in between rather than for this court to say yay or nay to whether 109 applies?
Justice Stewart, I, in response to that, I would say, look, there are very valid policy arguments on both sides of this equation, and it's a very sensitive and potentially, well, in the case of Madison, has been controversial issues. I agree with everything you said about that. Whatever the policy considerations, though, aren't telling us what the General Assembly has already chosen. And in our view, if the General Assembly had chosen that any school employee who's armed at the school after receiving such authorization were subject to peace officer training, then the General Assembly would have much more clearly said that. 109.78.
Well, but isn't it incumbent upon the General Assembly to know the laws that would be applicable? If the statute that authorizes an educator to have a gun inside or around the building, then that doesn't mean that all other provisions of the revised code does not apply.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. We'll concede that, Justice Stewart. If this court concludes that residual clause of 109.78D covers a teacher who is authorized to carry a weapon at school, but even though that's not her primary responsibility or that she's not in a primarily security-oriented role. If the courts were to conclude that, then absolutely, 109.78D applies. That teacher has to go to peace officer training. My side loses this case.
Well, again, you go to the primary purpose, and that's not included in the statute. But let's say in worst possible scenario, there's an active shooter in the building. Wouldn't we want the people whose primary purpose is not security, is teaching, is custodial work, is clerical work, but there's an active shooter in the building and there are employees who are non-police officers or law enforcement people who have weapons. In that scenario, we're gonna want someone who has that weapon to be trained somehow in some way, you know, to I guess, counter the adrenaline flowing, know about safety procedures. You know, I wouldn't want me in a building with a gun, just knowing that pulling the trigger does the job. So why are they different when it comes to an actor shooter scenario?
Well, they are, and again, I agree with everything you said about that, Justice Stewart, as a policy proposition. You'll get no argument from me about that.
If we say 109 doesn't apply, then do we allow non-law enforcement personnel to carry a weapon hope that they do the right thing with it?
If you say 109 doesn't apply, we're entrusting local boards of education to make these decisions appropriately. And they are entrusted with all sorts of decisions regarding the safety, education, development, welfare of school staffs.
In this particular case, if we say 109.78 doesn't apply, if we say today it doesn't apply, then what is there in place? Because I'm assuming if we say it doesn't apply, then the members, the non-law enforcement educators in the school can begin to carry and bring a weapon into the school. What is there in place that ensures parents that there is some safety with these weapons being probably in close proximity to their children, how they're locked up, how they're used? What's in place now?
Two things, Your Honor. First, if the school's policy is a concealed policy, as it is in the case before the court, then there are the training requirements and prerequisites that are applicable to anyone who has a concealed carry license in Ohio. Second.
Okay, what if a teacher just wants to carry one on her belt? So it's not concealed.
Well, it would have, for starters, the school would have to permit that. It would have to permit open carry. In that case, and it brings me to my second point in response to your question.
Well, it only has to be permitted if authorized, right?
That's correct, Justice DeWine. That's correct. And the second backstop, we would not have a statewide legislative answer to that question, Justice Stewart. What we would have is local answers to that question. And in the case of Madison, the policy requires 24 hours of active shooter training, various backgrounds, psychological checks, and so on and so forth. So the policy questions that you're posing are great ones, and they're the ones that the Madison School District wrestled with when it adopted the policy, and it adopted various prerequisites to make sure that the employees who were authorized had the appropriate amount of training in the eyes of the board. So it isn't, we're not in a scenario where it's a free-for-all. If you say 109.78D doesn't apply, there are some other backdrop Ohio statutes that would apply conceivably, at least in the case of concealed carry. But fundamentally, it's, in our view, the General Assembly trusted local boards of education to do what was appropriate for their individual districts.
Mr. Blakenstorfer?
Yes,
what is the difference between ordinary linguistics and plain language from a legal standpoint?
There's probably not any, Justice Brunner. I'm using ordinary linguistics as a way of getting away from saying we should apply the canon of justum generis here. But justum generis Plain language it's all coming down in this case, in our view, to basically the same principle, which is that ordinary English speakers look at a phrase, a sequence like this, A, B, or other C, and understand that C has to be interpreted within the context of A and B, what came before it. So I wasn't trying to use ordinary linguistics in any particular way. I was just saying that this principle that we're wrestling with here of interpretation really reflects the very common sense notion that words have to be interpreted in their context, not divorced from it.
Thank you.
Can we spent a lot of time talking about policy preferences, but I guess I'd like to get back to the language of the statute. And you know, the chief was asking you about an algebra teacher. You had a conversation with the chief about an algebra teacher. But an algebra teacher who also happened to be authorized to carry a weapon. But if you look at the statute, an algebra teacher is not someone who is in a position that goes armed while on duty, is it?
I fully agree with that, Justice DeWine, that a position in which such person goes armed while on duty.
That refers to the position, whether they happen to be authorized to have a gun as well, right?
That's correct. And it's a very odd way for the General Assembly to have described any employee who is authorized under the authorization statute. My response to Chief Justice O'Connor was indicating that, at least I was trying to, and it may not have been very articulate, that yes, if you pluck out the word position, algebra teacher holds a position at the school. If you pluck out the word or phrase on duty, yes, the algebra teacher is at the school working. And if you pluck out the word armed, then yes, literally, that algebra teacher who is authorized to carry a weapon meets those three tests if you pluck them out from the phrase. But the point that we've tried to make in the briefs and hope trying to make today is that's not an appropriate way of statutory interpretation. The words are in a context, and that context illuminates and gives meaning to the phrase as a whole.
Council, would you agree that if a school building has a special police officer, that the algebra teacher would not be the designated person to be carrying a weapon?
Chief Justice O'Connor, you're saying if there's a designated security?
No. If the school building, all right, has a special police officer or a security guard hired for that purpose, stationed at that school, the algebra teacher wouldn't be armed.
Well, the algebra teacher could be armed if the board so authorized.
Okay, so you're saying that, I understand that, but it theoretically would not be necessary to have the algebra teacher armed if you've already hired personnel to be your safety, what do you call them, a backstop?
Right.
Okay.
That could be true, Your Honor. And in some districts like Madison, the district at issue here, does have a school resource officer who is, you know, we would fully concede, actually has two at this point, at the time of the events in question had one, fully concede would be covered by 109.7AD because that person is in an other position in which he goes armed while on duty.
But that doesn't stop the educator from being armed either.
That's correct. That's correct, Justice Stewart.
You can have someone who has had the peace officer training, a security guard or special police officer or resource officer, correct? That has all the training we're talking about.
Correct.
And then you could have an algebra teacher that in Madison County had 24 hours of active shooter training. And they could all be operating simultaneously in the event that there's a threat at the school.
That's correct, Chief Justice O'Connor. That is correct. And the point and the reason we think that makes sense and is what the General Assembly has intended, is because the teacher, the algebra teacher who is armed, the goal is for that person never, ever, ever to have to use that weapon. Whereas the school resource officer or the security guard, that's the entirety of that person's job. And we think that is a reasonable distinction that could be drawn and that the General Assembly has in fact drawn with the way it has worded 109.78D.
All right, well then what about a school district that doesn't have a security officer or a special police officer or a resource officer? All they have is the armed algebra teacher. Doesn't that take that teacher and transform that teacher into the employee according to the statute's language, let me find it, is armed during a school day while going about their duty? In other words, they're the designee at that school. That takes them out of the realm of just being your average teacher and puts them into the classification as the backstop, security.
It's certainly a closer case, Chief Justice O'Connor, but I think we'd have to look at, you know, the specifics of the situation to see, is this person in a position in which the person goes armed while on duty? And to figure that out, I think we're looking at things like what is in this person's job description? How much time does this person spend doing that versus doing teaching algebra, for instance?
Well, so presumably he's got he's armed throughout the school day.
Right. But if all he is armed throughout the school day and he's hired as an algebra teacher, our contention would be that person is still not encompassed by 109.78D because that is not a position in which the person goes armed while on duty. It's a person who has been authorized, typically on a totally voluntary basis, to carry a weapon at the school.
I want to get to your authorization statute because that's where I believe the beginning is. A concealed carry permit holder is still prohibited from bringing a firearm in a school. They can lock it in their car in a secure place, leave it there, but then they have to enter the building without that gun. That's the criminal statute. What you're calling an authorization statute is really something that says this concealed permit holder is no longer violating this criminal statute if the board gives them permission to conceal carry their firearm into the building. But in order for the school board to do that, they have to create a policy that would allow a concealed carry permit holder to bring it into the building. They establish the policies and the additional training mechanisms, which would allow that permit holder to bring the gun into the building. You're not changing their role. They're not a security officer. They are just a concealed carry permit holder that now is not subject to a criminal charge because the school board has authorized this permit holder with additional training to bring their gun into the school.
I think I agree with everything you just said, Justice Kennedy. And I would add that with that regime as the backdrop, yes, it is certainly possible that 109.78 in theory could then put an overlay of training requirements on the regime and backdrop you just described. Our point is—
Do you agree with me that is what you're calling the authorization statute? It is a criminal statute that says, in one exception, it is not a crime. You are not prohibited as a concealed carry permit holder to bring your gun into the school building if the local board has established a policy, you've complied with the training, the additional training, which here is faster, and then you get authorization to bring your gun. You're still a teacher. You're not a police officer. You're not a security guard. You are just a concealed carry permit holder that's allowed to bring your gun into the building.
I agree with that, Justice Kennedy. Yes.
Well, counsel, for what purpose are you allowed to bring your gun into the building?
The purpose, as has been discussed, is to provide
security.
A backdrop in the event of an active shooter situation or something like that.
To provide security to the building and its occupants.
Yes, absolutely, Chief Justice O'Connor. And again, schools hope that it never comes to that. But 109.78, repeating myself at this point, it does not indicate that any employee so authorized. It indicates only those who are in other position in which they go armed while on duty. And we just think that is a very odd way for the General Assembly to have encompassed everybody that might be authorized.
But it's not just everybody. It's whomever the school board authorizes to do this. So not every teacher, just because they have a CCW, can go in and bring their school, again, bring their gun into the school.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And if I was vague or
unclear, No, you're not. I just want to make that point that this is a special person that has been identified to be a security entity for that school.
I do not disagree with that, Chief Justice O'Connor. Where I would respectfully disagree is with the interpretation of 109.78D, and that residual clause is connected back to people whose full-time jobs, primary responsibilities, are the provision of safety and security in the school, as opposed to the volunteer algebra teacher.
Mr. Blickensterfer, isn't that the reason why in the policy they're called volunteers, to avoid the application of 109.78D?
I don't think it is, Justice Bruner. I think it's more about, you know, not mandating it to the teachers who have stepped up and agreed to do that. And I would also point out that even the under the other side's interpretation, there are gaps in coverage here that are of relevance, and we think sort of, you know, illuminate what 109.78D is really trying to get at. For instance, it's perfectly clear that 109.78D would not apply to a citizen volunteer, and it doesn't appear to apply to an independent contractor the school might use either, because it's all tied to employment. So the General Assembly has not covered the waterfront here with this training requirement. I think that is reasonably clear. And then the real debate about is, to what extent have they covered the waterfront with respect to employees? We think that phrase in 109.78D is intended to define a subset of employees, not the entirety of employees.
Council, could a school board say you can bring your gun to a school, Mr. Algebra teacher, because you have a CCW permit and nothing more is necessary?
In theory, yes. Chief
okay, Justice so Parker. You can have a patchwork amongst the school districts as to who can bring, what is the caliber of training, no pun intended, of training that each algebra teacher can have, from one high school to another high school in neighboring community.
Yes, that
okay,
is.
All right, let me take it a step further. Do you think that algebra teacher could be the security at a football game? It played on the premises of the school.
The board could certainly, if the algebra teacher is authorized to carry, the algebra teacher could be at the football game and carrying, and again, in a literal fashion, would be providing some form of security. I would still argue that algebra teacher is not in a position, unless she is mandated, or that's part of her job description, I would still argue that she's not in a position in which she goes armed while on duty. She's been authorized to and has agreed to bring a
weapon. Well, I'm just trying to create a scenario here when it would be pretty ridiculous to have the algebra teacher in a stadium armed and authorized to use their weapon to be the security for the school. So, all right. Well, we've used up quite a bit of time here, and I think
that ask one thing, Chief.
I mean, okay.
You keep asking Mr. Wickensdorf about someone being the security for the school, but that's not what we're talking about here, right? We're talking about someone who's authorized to carry a firearm and is there in case there's an active school shooter situation to someone else. But if in that hypothetical, the algebra teacher became a security guard and their job was to provide security for the football stadium, then they would fall under the statute and have to have the extra training requirement, correct?
I agree with that, Justice DeWine.
So this is not a question of school boards authorizing teachers to be pseudo security guards. It's a question of school boards concerned about active shooter situations and wanting to make sure that some teachers who have training have the firearms available. And that's what this is about, isn't it?
I absolutely agree with that, Justice DeWine. In our view, the line that the General Assembly has drawn is between those employees who are in what is primarily and whose job duties involves being armed versus those employees who do not, but may be authorized to be armed. And reasonable people can disagree about that policy line, but we believe that the wording of the statute indicates that that is the policy line that the General Assembly has drawn.
All right, we'll go with Mr. Blakely.
I see we're well past time, so I'll just be very brief.
Yeah, we'll give you 5 minutes, Mr. Blakely.
Oh, thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. I represent the Attorney General, and I want to make two quick points, one about the authorizing statute and one about the qualifications provision. First, with respect to the authorizing statute, Justice Kennedy resuscitated the law perfectly. And I think that answers Justice Stewart's question about the overarching goal of the authorizing statute and the qualifications provision together. And that is the General Assembly entrusted the local school districts to make decisions on a case-by-case basis as to what the needs and capabilities of each school are when preparing for an active shooter scenario. Chief Justice O'Connor mentioned there could be a patchwork amongst the states. That's exactly what the General Assembly wanted. Some school districts could decide not to allow anyone to carry a firearm on campus, whereas other school districts, like the district here, could decide, well, a few teachers or librarians, they can carry, provided that they meet certain training requirements. And that's important because some school districts might not have funding to hire additional police officers or security guards, but the need to protect the safety of the school children is as great today as it's ever been. So the General Assembly wants those local school districts to be able to assess, what are the capabilities of this school? What funding do you have? And do you think teachers should be allowed to carry? So then this goes to the second point. What does the qualifications provision do? Well, it doesn't strip those local school districts of that flexibility the General Assembly gave them. All the qualifications provision does is it's triggered when a school district employs a person in a specific type of position. Now, this case comes down to meaning. What does the qualifications provision mean when it says schools are prohibited from employing a person as a police officer, security guard, or other position in which such person goes armed while on duty? And Chief Justice O'Connor, you were focused on their primary duty, but I think Justice DeWine has it more correct, and it's they're employed in a particular position. Yes, some employees will be carrying a firearm. And that teacher, it's important to remember, they're already employed as a teacher, but the fact that they're carrying a firearm doesn't change the fact that they're employed in the exact same position as every other teacher in the school district.
Are they assuming an additional duty?
Pardon, Your Honor?
Are they assuming an additional duty?
They are authorized to carry a firearm.
Is that an additional duty, additional to teaching?
No, it's an option. It's an option to carry a firearm. Now,
no, I understand that, counsel. I understand it's optional. You can volunteer. You don't have to do it. Maybe none of the teachers in the school will volunteer to do it. But once you volunteer to do it, you assume that duty, that privilege to carry a weapon in the school is placed on you, and that is your duty.
So I think I want to use the word duty lightly here, because in one sense, to have that duty would mean you are required to act should there be an active shooter scenario. So in that sense, no, there is no duty. In another sense, yeah, you're carrying a firearm on campus. You could theoretically act in a way that other individuals might not act. But again, it doesn't change the position that they're employed in. And you brought up the example of the algebra.
Someone, for example, a teacher volunteers to take on the key club. They're still a teacher, right? That's their primary position is still algebra teacher. It's not, does it change that position because they volunteer to do something else, does it?
That's exactly correct. And we can go on and talk about all the different factual permutations in which this might arise. But the fact of the matter is, unless there is some sort of elevation of status, and I think Chief Justice O'Connor's example of the algebra teacher in the football stadium is the perfect example. There, it's after hours, it's during a non-school sporting event, or during a school sporting event, but it's after the school day. That individual, if they are so authorized to carry that firearm, they're not acting in a position as a teacher. They're acting in a position as a security officer, and then they would be required to graduate from the training academy. But when we're talking about the day-to-day teachers who are already employed as teachers, and they're simply authorized to carry the firearm, nothing changes as a practical matter. And then second, the last point I want to make briefly is just that if Gabbard's proposed construction is correct, then that would lead to a lot of surprising results, the most glaring of which is if Gabbard's correct, then school districts would have total discretion to allow parents to bring a firearm with them every day when they pick up their children. But when it comes to school employees, individuals that the district have direct control over, they directly oversee, the hurdles would be much, much higher. That's not the only unreasonable consequence. Another is that if Gabbard's correct, then authorized teachers would essentially have to become police officers in order to carry a firearm. They'd be required to undergo training that's not just directed at firearm safety, which is important, but it's also directed at traffic training, 125 hours of field sobriety testing, car crashes, 24 hours of driving a patrol car, 12 hours of human trafficking, 12 hours of domestic violence, and so on and so forth. It would be really surprising if the General Assembly had wanted school districts to allow teachers to carry a firearm, but only if they became police officers.
Well, counsel, that wouldn't be the first time that there was some a statute passed that was inadvertent when it came to and needed some cleanup afterwards for some clarification or modification.
You're absolutely right, but that's why the authorization statute is really important here. It demonstrates that the General Assembly enacted this provision that focused on local control. We trust you, school districts, to make these decisions, set requirements that are required for these teachers to pass with. But as soon as you cross that threshold, if their employment status changes, if there are security-related personnel, that's when we require statewide uniformity. That's the balance that the General Assembly struck, and I think that's the most reasoned outcome in this case. So unless the court has any questions, I just want to briefly conclude that if a school district allows a teacher to carry a firearm, Ohio law does not require that teacher to then become a police officer. So the district, the 12th district's opinion should be reversed.
Counselor, one quick question. Why can't the General Assembly just simply say 109.78 isn't applicable?
They certainly could have, Your Honor, but they could have said the opposite. They could have said 109.78 is applicable. So when you're in this conundrum, what do you do? You look at the words of the statute in context. And here, it hasn't really been discussed much, but part of looking at context is looking at semantic or linguistic canons of construction. We think Judge Powell in paragraph 45 below correctly applied justum generis. So here, to directly respond to your question, Justice Stewart, there's a conundrum on both sides. What do? You apply statutory interpretive principles. And every interpretive principle used favors the school district in this case, and it demonstrates why Gabbard's proposed construction is not correct.
Blakely, if you can read the plain language and apply both statutes, you don't need to interpret. You don't need to get into statutory interpretation. And the court has said that as recently as 2017 in State X. Roe Clay. anyways, out of Cuyahoga County. So why doesn't plain language just work?
So Your Honor is correct. There is that precedent. There's also precedent in Hooper where the court says you cannot declare a statute to be clear without first taking into the context. And that's because the meaning of words can vary according to context. So you have these two precedents that seem contradictory, but they can be harmonized. And that's because there's two different types of interpretive canons. On the one hand, you have the more substantive canons that are rooted in policy-based considerations. Rule of lenity is a great example. There, if a criminal statute's unclear, courts from a policy perspective say, we're going to construe it narrowly. That would go towards Your Honor's latter precedent, which says we don't interpret unambiguous statutes. But when it comes to the other precedent, that has to do more with grammar, linguistic canons. Eustem generis, nascitur cici, these Latin canons.
But excuse me, but what is ambiguous about either one of these statutes? There's nothing ambiguous about either one taken separately.
There's certainly nothing ambiguous about the authorizing statute. When it comes to the qualifications provision, it's unclear, and here's why. It appears in a statute that addresses the Police Officer Training Commission, specifically the certification of police officers, security guards, and persons who are privately employed in a police capacity. As a whole, Section 109.78 deals with security personnel. That's the context. But even within the qualifications provision, we see the General Assembly expressly targeted police officers and security guards. So when we get to that residual clause, other position, the question is, well, does that apply to non-security personnel? Maybe, but maybe not. The fact is, the words are not entirely clear, and that's why we need to apply these grammatical interpretive canons of interpretation to see not just what the words mean in isolation, but also what the words mean in conjunction with the other words in the statute that the General Assembly passed.
I mean, aren't these canons just really part and parcel of how we read things? I mean, I know we have this precedent out there that says, well, you don't apply canons unless a statute's ambiguous, but really, you know, most canons, or at least those kind of canons, are based upon how we think and read. For example, if we had a rule in court that said you can't have Coke, Pepsi, Mountain Dew, Dr. Pepper, or any other soda in court, we would know that that meant soda, like soda pop. That didn't mean baking soda or sodium bicarbonate, because that's common sense. That's part of how we read. We don't have to declare that sentence ambiguous in order to apply that canon and know that we can't, that doesn't mean you can't bring baking soda in. I think that's the point you're trying to make about these canons and this idea that, well, you can only apply a canon when the statute is ambiguous, really is nonsensical, because we can't read, we don't process without understanding what some of these canons are.
That's correct. And that's why we're focusing on that. It's dealing with grammatical rules, linguistic rules. And the reason why eustem generis or the other canons come into play is they should confirm that plain meaning, Justice Bruner. And here, Gabbert's proposed plain meaning is not confirmed by eustem generis, which there's no question it applies.
Mr. Blakely, it's Clay versus Cuyahoga County Medical Examiner from 2017. And we specifically said, under our rules of statutory construction, ambiguity means that the statutory provision is capable of bearing more than one meaning. That doesn't fit in your scenario, unless you can explain to me how it does.
It's not that it's capable of bearing more than
that's
one
the
meaning.
That's the black letter law I just read to you.
Oh, certainly, Your Honor. But when we're applying that black letter law to our case, in light of the other precedent that says you need to take context into consideration, when we look at that statute, first pass, ordinary citizen reading this, it's not entirely clear that that language would apply to a non-security personnel. And so we need to dig a little deeper. We need to apply those grammatical rules and say, confirm that plain meaning reading. And when we apply eustem generis, it confirms security personnel are not covered by the qualifications provision.
The problem is when we don't like the outcome, I mean, sometimes the plain meaning means that we don't like the outcome, and it's not our job to change what the legislature is required to change. If we're going to stay in our own lane, if we apply the plain meaning and it works, we don't need to go any further, and we've already said that.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor. It's not an outcome-based test at all. And again, that's why we keep drawing back to that authorizing statute. We need to keep in mind what the General Assembly enacted. They enacted a provision that entrusted the local school districts to make these decisions. So then when we're also reading, well, when does the qualifications provision apply? When is it triggered? We don't care about the outcome. We just care about what the General Assembly enacted in light of the authorization statute.
Well, but it's apples and oranges, because the school districts can enact these, they can adopt these policies, but the training issue is something that's already in the statute that they have to comply with. And I'm having trouble seeing how we read all this other into it when the two statutes can work, maybe not the way we'd like, but they're there and they work.
It's not that we would like them to work a certain way, it's the way that the General Assembly wanted them to work. They entrusted the school districts to enact training requirements. The policy at issue here, the teachers have to go active shooter training, they have to obtain a handgun qualification certificate, they have to pass a background test, drug test, mental health examination. Those local school districts, they're accountable to their community. The General Assembly knows that. And so if they, in the example I think was brought up earlier, if they just willy-nilly allow teachers to bring firearms on campus, they almost assuredly will be voted out of their seat, and a school district will enact much stricter training requirements. But the General Assembly also wanted statewide uniformity when it comes to that threshold when you're not just a teacher, you're not just a librarian, you're a full-blown security guard. That's when statewide uniformity is required.
I want to go back to your answer to Chief Justice O'Connor, and it was interrupted by another question. And you said they could act, but they are not required to act. There is no elevation of status, no duty. What do you mean by no duty? They could act, but they are not required to.
I think it's reasonable to assume that even if a school district authorizes a teacher to carry a firearm while on campus, that individual might be hesitant when the time arises. They might decide, I'm not fully comfortable with the situation. Maybe it's because of the locale of the shooter. Maybe it's because of where they are positioned. They essentially, just because they are carrying a firearm, does not mean that as soon as a rogue shooter enters premises, they must draw their weapon and they must fire. In fact, that's what training those individuals would be important, knowing when to pull out your firearm and knowing when not to.
And would you say that's the same if you're a police officer or hired security? Or do you have the obligation to act because you are the police officer, you are security?
I think it would come down to the job description, but I would bet my bottom dollar that those security guards, those police officers, they are hired to actively protect the safety of the children and the employees. Whereas the teachers, it's more of a, as my friend Mr. Blickensterfer commented, a backstop. They're there just in case, at the last resort, and hopefully that is how these local school districts can protect their children.
What's the first resort?
I'm sorry, Chief, go ahead.
Council, what's the first resort? They're the last resort. What's the first resort?
Hopefully, if the school districts have enough funding, they're the police officers.
Okay, but they don't. But they don't. You've got algebra teachers carrying weapons because you don't have a security officer, you don't have a police officer, you don't have a resource officer. You've got nobody but the administration and the teacher and maybe the librarian.
So this is why it's important. It's not a title test, it's an effects test. If we're in that type of school where there is nobody, yet the school district says, listen, we need some protection, sixth grade algebra teacher, we are going to vest in you this power. That is a substantive change in employment position. We expect there to be paperwork filed, signatures, you know, advance in pay, so on and forth. But substantively, that employment position will change. And then that individual would be covered by the qualifications provision.
Wait a minute, are you saying that that happens in school districts?
Oh, we're not saying that happens, but this is the point of what the General Assembly wanted. They wanted to give those school districts the flexibility to decide what capabilities do we have and what do we need to do to protect our children. And if they need to do what Your Honor is suggesting, then likely that individual would fall within the qualifications provision.
So but, you're saying if the algebra teacher is the only armed individual, adult, in that school, that transforms them into a security officer?
Not necessarily. There's a lot more that goes into it. It's not just a clean, oh, you're the only one, you must be qualified. It's what goes into it. What did the school district have in mind when they vested the power in this individual to carry a firearm. Admittedly, there will need to be some factual determinations, and courts deal with these things all the time. But when it comes to just the regular run-of-the-mill teacher who's authorized to carry a firearm, nothing changed in their employment position, nothing changes in their duties. They simply do not fall within that qualifications provision. They're still going to need to meet those training requirements that the school district set out, but they don't need to become a police officer.
Okay.
Counsel, in God forbid, an event takes place where there's an active shooter and one of these teachers voluntarily assumes, you already say they don't have to, but if they do and they go to protect others, and presumably police officers are going to be called to the scene who have received the proper qualifications that the state law permits. Now you're going to have untrained people interacting with trained police officers. Isn't that the type of situation that the General Assembly did not exactly wanted to protect against, about having people, if you're going to give people the power to have a gun and use it, that you have to be properly trained?
I think if that situation were to arise, the teacher who's authorized to carry the firearm, they would know their role and what the purpose of them carrying that firearm is. So as soon as they see outside police officers coming onto campus, I guarantee they would defer to them. They would back down slowly, unless they were in that position where they were the one standing off, then the police would come assist them. And there would be some sort of transition process. The police are adequately trained in those scenarios, and I bet they would handle that situation very well.
Right. Well, what if they're hearing shots and they're assuming that they're coming from the active shooter, but they're actually coming from police officers trying to take control of the situation, and a police officer is now placed in danger because you have an untrained individual making a mistake like this?
That's certainly a concern. Again, I'm not sure about the specifics of the training requirements that this school district has, but it's possible that in those training requirements, there's information that says if you see outside police officers on campus already engaging in the decombating the active shooter, then you are not to act. Perhaps that's a scenario. Another thing just to take into consideration is if we're dealing with an active, a rogue shooter versus police and then teachers, I think they're going to be dressed a little bit differently. So you'll easily be able to identify who are the parties at issue here. So again, it's just a lot of factual uncertainties that matter on the ground. But when it comes to interpreting these statutes, what the General Assembly wanted, I think it's fair to say that local control, allow those school districts to determine what the schools need on a case-by-case basis. But if you're going to elevate that individual to a security personnel, they do have to undergo that training under 109.78.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bloom or Ms. Blumkratz.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, Rachel Blumkratz on behalf of the appellees. We've just had a lot of discussion about specific duties of individuals. Do they have to respond or not? Or their job title? How much of their time must they be providing security? Mr. Blickensderfer said they have to be full-time. Then we're talking about maybe just at a game in the evening. We've talked about, well, did they sign particular papers that say special things, or what was the school's intent in allowing them to go armed? Under the Attorney General and the board's interpretation, by the Attorney General's own admission, there could be countless factual permutations. That's what he writes, that boards and teachers and parents and courts will have to sort through to try and figure out who is covered or not. But that's not what the legislature did. The legislature drew a bright line with its text, its plain language text in 109.78D. It says, and I know we know the text, but it's important to come back to it. It says that a school cannot employ a person as a special police officer, security guard, or other position in which such person, that employee, goes armed while on duty unless they have the requisite training or experience. The statute, by its plain text, is not limited to just security positions or similar or full-time security positions or positions requiring you to go armed. It just says other position different to or in addition from a security guard or a special police officer in which such person, that employee, goes armed while on duty. And when the legislature has already been clear and has already identified clearly, unambiguously, what triggers that training requirement, it would be improper for this court to add more limitations, to add more qualifying phrases that are not in
the understand text. How, say, an algebra teacher, that's a position in which a person goes armed while on duty. Because obviously position, armed while on duty modifies position. So how is a teaching position where some teachers may be carrying firearms, others may not, how is that a position in which such a person goes armed while on duty?
Yes, Your Honor. The statute, just based on its plain text, isn't limited to particular positions or positions that have particular job descriptions. Position just means job, and it could be any job in the school.
Why wouldn't the statute just say any person who goes armed while on duty? Why does it say employed in a position?
Well, Your Honor, I think it makes sense that it says the word position because we're talking about employees, and everybody at a school or is employed in a position. And what's it specifying is that it doesn't want the positions just to be limited to that security guard or just that special police officer, but other positions beyond that in which such person, right, not is required to go armed while on duty, but such person, that person it employs, goes armed while on duty. And we know from the legislature here that they're not getting at job categories or job titles, but they're getting at what that individual does, because they use the word person 3 times in this one sentence. This is about that person. The statute says a school cannot employ a person, right, as a special police officer, security guard, or other position in which such person, which that employee, goes armed while on duty. And then it says, unless the person, right, we're talking about the same person, has 20 years experience as a police officer or has met the training requirement. And that way, again, the boards, the courts, parents, all who are involved don't have to sort through. Does somebody do 51% of their time doing security? This guy is called the coach. Well, he does 2 periods of security outside. You know, is that going to be somebody who needs this in the statute or not? Indeed, it was referred to earlier.
To be fair, that's really not what your opponents are asking for. I think what they're saying is position means whether it's integral to the position. I mean, that seems a pretty straightforward test.
Well, Your Honor, to be completely fair, my opponents in this case have tried to define that other position phrase so many different ways. Sometimes they say it has to be a security-related position. Other times they say security personnel. Sometimes they say primary duties. So that's not full-time or integral. Primary duties are security-related. Other times they say you have to be required to carry a firearm or it be inherent in your job.
So one of the points they raise is that under your reading, the school board could authorize some non-employees, retirees, whatever, to walk around the school and carry firearms. Do you disagree with that?
No, Your Honor. The statute, by its plain text, just applies to employees.
The school board could say that we're going to authorize other people to carry guns at school, just not teachers there.
If that circumstance happened to come up, if it were something that was happening,
does that make any sense? I mean, is that?
Well, I think it just reflects. I think it just reflects that the legislature hasn't addressed a circumstance that doesn't seem to be happening. There's certainly nothing in the record. I'm certainly not aware of schools that are having parents patrol the hallways going armed, and it doesn't take away from the fact that the legislature did address the scenario that we have here, which is employees. And also there are all sorts of anomalies that go along with the board's interpretation. Under the board's interpretation, a security guard or an SRO has to get lots of training in order to make sure we know that person is going to be safe carrying a gun around schools or around kids at schools. But then the algebra teacher, who we like to pick on apparently, this algebra teacher can go carrying around kids in the class all day, every day, with just 8 hours of that concealed carry training, six of which can be completed online, or none whatsoever if they open carry. That's certainly anomalous. The FOP.
But that's not what happened here, right? It wasn't just the 8 hours. The school board mandated additional training.
The school board here mandated 24 hours of training, Your Honor. That's still less training than to be a little league umpire.
But it's not eight, to be fair.
But certainly the consequences of the board's interpretation, as Mr. Blickensterfer explained, was that algebra teacher can go armed while on duty with just 8 hours of training. And if
the board authorized them to do so, which the board didn't.
Right, the board authorized here less training than a little league umpire, less training than a nail technician in Ohio needs.
Those are policy questions about how much training, what kind of training, for how long, what duration, frequency, repetition, along with drug analysis, mental health, all that other stuff. But when you get back to what I call the enabling language, it comes out of a criminal statute. It is a crime to carry a concealed weapon, even for a permit holder, into a school premises. You are relieved of being charged with criminal conduct if a school board has authorized you to bring your gun into school based on whatever policies that they create. They're saying you cannot be charged with a crime. That 2923 provision, how is it then that you get in reading what you cannot be charged with a crime for doing into a position of 190? I'm just saying, you carry concealed permit holder, you are now permitted to bring your gun into school. Your job hasn't changed. You have no enforcement provisions. You're not doing investigations, citing the criminal code. You're not doing anything like that. You are just an algebra teacher who is now permitted as a concealed carry permit holder to bring your gun into school. How does that relief of a criminal liability, how does that relief of a criminal prohibition somehow change you into a police officer that 190 applies?
Your Honor, a few responses, if I may, and I'd like to address this interaction between the statutes. And certainly, Justice Kennedy, you're completely correct. 2923 is a criminal statute. And in 1992, when the General Assembly decided to make it illegal to carry a gun into a school safety zone, it allowed school boards to give an exemption for anyone who has written authorization by that school safety, by the school board, right? But it did not give boards broad, unfettered discretion to displace all other areas of the revised code that may apply. And indeed, Mr. Blickensterfer concedes as much. He concedes that the concealed carry permit requirement training would apply. He concedes that if 10978D were applicable, then it would also constrain the board's authority to have people go armed while on duty in the school safety zone. The training requirement was already in existence when in 1992 they brought D1A, this exception to the criminality of bringing a gun into a school safety zone. And they didn't mention training. They're completely silent to that. And that silence, again, it doesn't displace, it doesn't supersede anything else in the revised code. And the statute doesn't say that now schools can develop whatever sort of armed teacher program that it wants, the terms and conditions, notwithstanding anything else in the revised code. No, on one hand, we have D1A, this criminal statute, which says that individuals won't face criminal penalties as long as they have the school board authorization. But that doesn't displace, on the other hand, 10978D that says how much training employees have to have. And indeed, that criminal exception is important because then if the school board wanted to send that algebra teacher to get trained, even if they had the training, if they carried a gun into a school safety zone, right, that would be illegal but for that exemption in D1A by having that board authorization. So that board authorization was important even for your well-trained staff members that meet the criteria of 10978D.
Council, let me ask something.
Of course, Your Honor.
Sorry to interrupt you. Say you're a teacher with a concealed carry permit, and you go through all the things required by the Madison Local District, mental health and 24 hours and all that. Are you required to bring your concealed carry to the school every day?
Your Honor, my understanding is that you are authorized, the authorization letters, you're authorized to bring the gun to school and to have it 100% of the time on duty.
But are you required?
So I do not think that you're required to.
You're not required. It's not a duty.
No, Your Honor, you're not required to. The armed staff in this case did testify that they do indeed bring the their firearm with them every single day to school and have it while they're on duty. But again, the statute, and bringing it back to the plain text of the statute, which is, I always think, our North Star in these statutory interpretation cases, it doesn't say an individual goes armed while on security duty, or that an individual goes armed for the purpose of providing security. As long as that individual is authorized to go armed while on duty at school, they meet the basic plain language of the statute, and therefore the training requirements apply, even if they're not required to do it. And that's why the 12th District, it recognized this distinction between people who volunteer or who are paid to go armed while on duty. It's really not significant based on the plain text of the statute. The statute doesn't say paid to go armed while on duty or hired to go armed on duty. It says no school shall employ a person. These are all individuals who are indeed employed by the Madison Local School District, and they all go armed while on duty. They indeed go armed in their positions as teachers or librarians or cafeteria workers while on duty at the Madison Local School.
Counselor, does D1A permit a parent who volunteers and assists maybe as a teacher's aide? Is that person exempt? An unpaid, but comes in and helps the sixth grade algebra teacher?
Generally, no, Your Honor, it does not. They would have to have special authorization from a school district in order to do that. And I would note that all the categories that are explicitly mentioned in D1A, as you're mentioning, Justice Stewart, those people are law enforcement officers. They are state and federal agents.
Right, but we're looking at the language or any other person.
That's correct, Your Honor. So it is theoretically possible that boards could allow parents or other individuals to come into the school armed and volunteer. But again, I think this is a situation that the legislature just hasn't addressed because it hasn't come up. We don't expect the legislature to address every single circumstance, particularly hypothetical circumstances. If it happened to be that schools start to have armed patrols of community members and parents, then that's something that the legislature can address. What they've addressed in this statute and what this court has to follow is the language of this statute, which clearly applies to employees who go armed while on duty at school. It doesn't give an exemption for teachers. It doesn't give an exemption for just anyone who has that authorization from the school board in D1A. Certainly that's something the legislature could do. I don't deny that. And indeed, there have been proposals by different legislatures to do just that. They know how to make those exemptions, but that's not the law.
So your simple answer, though, is yes, the parent, volunteer, teacher, assistant, this D1A could apply to that person, too. Not an algebra teacher, not a librarian, not a security guard, just a parent volunteering his or her time. This would apply to the board could authorize, and let's say she's a concealed carry, permit user. This would allow her to carry a concealed weapon into the school.
under D1A, if the school board gave that volunteer parent non-employee authorization, then yes, you could.
And the statute does allow the school board to do that.
It does allow the school board to do that. If there is a shooting expert that wants to come in and help the
is your average mother who is a concealed carry person and who helps volunteer in her child's class.
It's certainly theoretically possible, Your Honor. I think there are lots of places, though, in the revised code where we make requirements on our employees that we don't make on our volunteers. Certainly
that happens in the school system. This statute isn't one of them. The statute doesn't make a distinction when it says than any other person.
Well, D1A doesn't make any distinction, Your Honor, but 10978D is very clear that it does apply to employees who go armed while on duty. Those are our people who are going to be around kids all day, every day, not just at pickup, not just at maybe these other times. This is the kindergarten teacher who's at circle time with the kids. I have a kindergartner, so I think about that. But these are, and this is a determination of the legislature. If the legislature wants to change it, of course, it's within the province of the legislature to decide that a POTA should make a training program that is more narrowly tailored to this particular circumstance. Indeed, there have been bills proposed that would do that, but that's not what the statute says now. And this court, rather than trying to change the law or write in exceptions or figure out the best policy outcome, it's bound to follow that plain text of the statute. And this statute, it doesn't draw a line, like Mr. Blinkensturfer says, between primary roles or full-time employees and other individuals. It just says the school shall not employ a person, right, as a special police officer, security guard, or other position, no limitations, in which such person goes armed while on duty. The legislature already drew us a bright line. It was already very clear about who it wanted to have that training. If that individual employee, if such person goes armed while on duty, and it would be really improper for us to imply all sorts of limitations into the statute that the legislature didn't put there. My friends on the other side, I hear them asking this court to apply adjusum generis. They wanna use new language and call it ordinary linguistics. This court has said time and time again that it does not apply any canons of statutory construction, including adjusum generis specifically.
But in all reality, we apply that canon all the time as part of ordinary English, right? Go back to my example earlier about if we have a rule that says that you can't have Diet Coke, Pepsi, or any other soda in the courtroom. We all know that doesn't mean you can't have baking soda. It doesn't mean you can't have sodium bicarbonate. We know what we're talking about, soda pop, because of the context, because of that can. So that's part of how we read, right? It's a little unfair to say that you never apply that unless there's ambiguity, because whether or not something's ambiguous depends on context and our basic linguistic tools that we use when we read and think, right?
Your Honor, I think there's a distinction between just thinking about context generally and specifically applying this narrowing canon, even when the legislature has already defined clearly can I use your example,
Let me ask you a question, then you can go back to it. Don't most of these linguistic canons simply reflect how people, the tools that we intuitively use when we read, not some of the canons, for example, the lenity one, but these linguistic ones. These are really just how people read and think.
Your Honor, I think sometimes they can and sometimes they can't. And that's why it's very dangerous to start applying canons or just start putting limiting phrases into the statute that the legislature hasn't put there. And I can use an example right from the Attorney General's brief, for example. They say, well, if your coach said, bring your jersey and your cleats or don't forget to bring your jersey and your cleats to the game. Okay. Or and other stuff to the game. Sorry if I'm messing up their hypothetical. I believe it's don't forget to bring your jersey and your cleats and other stuff to the game. Yes, maybe other stuff we don't think it means, you know, your television or something completely irrelevant to the game. But we wouldn't apply a jusum generis to that situation. We wouldn't say, okay, well, cleats and jerseys, those are just things you wear at an athletic game. So now the only things that other stuff could encompass are shin guards and socks, but it doesn't include your water bottle or your bats and balls, right? We don't give such narrow construction in our everyday speech as
we don't stop and explicitly apply the canon, but there's a reason that we, when you say other stuff, you're thinking of things in that category. That's because that's how people think about things.
Right, and that's why we wouldn't take a phrase or a sentence completely out of context and give it a meaning that doesn't make sense when it's back in the statutory context. But that's not what the 12th District did here, and that's not what we're asking for. We are talking about individuals who are carrying firearms on duty while in the school building and applying a training requirement to them. This is not something that does not make sense in the context, the same way as if you interpreted your sentence about Coke and Diet Pepper to include baking soda. It just wouldn't make sense in the context whatsoever. But we just don't have that scenario here. And I think that's one of the very dangerous things about ad jusum generis and other canons. You know, with what level of generality or specificity are you going to apply it? How narrow does it have to be? As I mentioned before, even the Attorney General and the board can't agree on how narrowly it would need to be applied here. If it applies just if you are primarily in a security related role, if you're just security personnel, if you are, do you have to be required to carry a firearm? The fact of the matter is this court luckily doesn't have to choose, doesn't have to write the statute itself because the legislature already did. The legislature already explained in plain language that this training requirement applies when a school employs a person, not just as a special police officer, not just as a security guard, but also in an other position in which such person goes armed while on duty.
Thank you. Do you have a question, Justice Bruner?
Very quick. 109.78D, one of the operative words is employ. The use of a volunteer in the policy of the Madison Local School District, do you think that that is an attempt to, I mean, can a teacher be employed and a volunteer at the same time so that they don't fall under the gambit of this 109.78D?
Well, Your Honor, I answer the question just by going back to that plain text, right? The plain text doesn't require that the armed staff be employed to go armed while on duty or hired to or paid to go armed while on duty. It just says that no school shall employ a person, right, in a position in which such person goes armed while on duty. So whether they're volunteering for it or not, they still are covered by the plain language of the statute. And certainly they are still doing it in their position as a teacher or a librarian. I think one of the justices brought up the example of a key club or some other voluntary activity. Just because a teacher volunteers to drive students to a science fair, right? It's about something they're volunteering to do. They're still doing it in their position as a teacher. And indeed, the authorization letters in this case, which are attached to the parent supplement, make it very clear that here the armed staff are only authorized to carry a firearm while on duty. It says to possess a firearm while on duty at Madison Local School. So this is not something they're doing separate from their duty on other times or things like this. This is what they're doing while on duty at Madison Local Schools.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Counsel?
Chief Justice,
Counsel, you've used all your time, so I'll give you 2 minutes.
I appreciate that, Chief Justice O'Connor, and appreciate the court's gone more than double the allotted time. I'm very, very appreciative of the court's indulgence in this case. So I'll try to be very quick. One is my friend on the other side, Ms. Bloom-Katz, multiple times emphasized that the General Assembly has adopted a bright line test in 109.78D. This is a very strange bright line test, the use of two specific terms with a residual phrase. It would have been so easy for the General Assembly to write a very clear, all-encompassing test that said no employee shall be in a school safety zone without having completed peace officer training. Or even more to the point, no person shall be in a school safety zone without having gone through peace officer training. As we've seen in 2923.122D, as Justice Stewart was indicating with one of her questions, the General Assembly certainly knows how to write text that encompasses the waterfront of a category, which respectfully suggests that's not what they did here. The final point I would point out, and again, we cannot use policy to determine what the statute means, but we can look at policy as a way of understanding why the statute might reasonably mean one thing or another. And the point I'd like to make about that, Your Honors, is that this is not a choice that the General Assembly made between peace officer training or a complete free-for-all. The choice the General Assembly made was between peace officer training for certain types of employees and the training that local boards of education are entrusted to require with respect to other folks. Again, thanks for the court's indulgence with its time today. And we respectfully ask that the court reverse the judgment of the 12th District.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess?